though not silent, as possible. He followed me shortly thereafter, landing beside me with a small thud. After that, we sprang forward with no delay. If Sonya had heard us, then there was no point in wasting time. We needed every advantage we could get. Dimitri grabbed the shovel and swung it hard into the glass. Once, twice. The first strike was about the height of my head, the second, lower. The glass fractured more with each impact. Right on the heels of the second hit, I pushed forward and shoved the wheelbarrow into the door. Lifting it and throwing it against the glass would have been a lot cooler, but it was too unwieldy to raise very high. When the wheelbarrow struck the already weakened glass, the cracked areas broke and crumbled altogether, creating a hole big enough for both of us to get through. We both had to duck, especially Dimitri. A simultaneous attack through both sides of the house would have been ideal, but it wasn't like Sonya could run out the front door. Nausea had started to creep over me as soon as we were near the patio, and the sensation hit full force as we entered a living room. I ignored my stomach in the way I'd perfected and braced myself for what was to come. We'd broken in pretty quickly, but not quickly enough to truly get the jump on Strigoi reflexes. Sonya Karp was right there, ready for us, doing all she could to avoid the sunlight spilling into the living room. When I'd first seen Dimitri as a Strigoi, I'd been so shocked that I'd frozen up. It had allowed him to capture me. So I'd mentally braced myself this time, knowing I'd feel the same shock when I saw my former teacher as a Strigoi. And it was shocking. Just like with him, so many of Sonya's features were the same as before. The auburn hair and high cheekbones. But her beauty was twisted by all the other terrible conditions. Chalky skin, red eyes, and the expression of cruelty that all Strigoi seemed to wear. If she recognized us, she gave no sign and lunged toward Dimitri with a snarl. It was a common Strigoi tactic to take out the bigger threat first, and it annoyed me that they always believed that was Dimitri. He'd shoved his stake in his belt in order to carry the shovel inside with him. The shovel wouldn't kill a Strigoi, but with enough strength and momentum, it would definitely keep Sonya at arm's length. He struck her with it in the shoulder after her first attempt, and while she didn't fall over, she definitely waited before trying another attack. They circled each other, like wolves readying for a battle, as she sized up her odds. One charge, and her greater strength would push him down, shovel or not. All of this took place in a matter of seconds, and Sonya's calculations had left me out of the equation. I made my own charge, slamming into her other side, but she saw me coming out of the corner of her eye and responded instantly, throwing me down while never taking her eyes off Dimitri. I wished I had the shovel and could hit her in the back from a safe distance. All I carried was my stake, and I had to be careful with it since it could kill her. I did a quick scan of her eerily normal living room and couldn't see any other potential weapons. She fainted, and Dimitri went for it. He just barely corrected himself as she leapt forward to take advantage of the situation. She thrust him against the wall, pinning him there and knocking the shovel from his grasp. He struggled against her, trying to break free as her hands found his throat. If I tried to pull her off, my strength combined with Dimitri's would probably free him. I wanted this over as quickly as possible, however, and decided to make a power play. I ran toward her, stake in hand, and plunged it through her right shoulder blade, hoping I was nowhere near her heart. The charmed silver, so agonizing to Strigoi's skin, made her scream. Frantic, she shoved me away with force that was astonishing even for a Strigoi. I fell backward, stumbling, and whacked my head against a coffee table. My vision dimmed slightly, but instinct and adrenaline drove me back to my feet. My attack gave Dimitri the split second he needed. He knocked Sonya to the ground and grabbed my stake, pushing it against her throat. She screamed and flailed, and I moved forward to help him, knowing how hard it was to pin a Strigoi.
"Get Sidney," he grunted. "The chain."
I moved as quickly as I could, stars and shadows dancing in front of me. I unlocked the front door and kicked it open as a signal, then ran back to Dimitri. Sonya was making good progress in fighting him off. I dropped to my knees, working with Dimitri to keep her restrained. He had that battle lust in his eyes again, a look that said he wanted to destroy her right here and now. But there was something else, too. Something that made me think he had more control, that my words in the alley had actually had an impact. Still, I uttered a warning. We need her. Remember, we need her. He gave me a slight nod, just as Sydney showed up lugging the chain. She stared at the scene wide-eyed, pausing only a moment before hurrying over to us. We'll make a warrior of her yet, I thought. Dimitri and I moved to our next task. We'd already spotted the best place to bind Sonya, a heavy reclining armchair in the corner. Lifting her, which was dangerous since she was still thrashing wildly, we thrust her into the chair. Then, keeping the stake at her neck, Dimitri attempted to hold her down while I grabbed hold of the chain. There was no time to think of a precise system. I just started wrapping it, first around her legs and then, as best as I could, around her torso, trying to lock her arms against her. Dimitri had bought a lot of chain, thankfully, and I hurriedly wrapped it around the chair in a crazy manner, doing everything I could to keep her down. When I finally ran out of chain, Sonya was pretty well locked into place. Was it something she could break out of? Absolutely. But with a silver stake against her, not so easy. With both in place, well, we had her trapped for now. It was the best we could do. Dimitri and I exchanged brief, weary looks. I felt dizzy but fought through it, knowing our task was far from over. Time for questioning, I said grimly. Chapter 17. The interrogation didn't go so well. Oh, sure, we made plenty of threats and used the stakes as torture devices, but not much came of it. Dimitri was still scary when dealing with Sonya, but after his breakdown with Donovan, he was careful not to fall into that berserk rage again. This was healthier for him in the long run, but not so good for scaring up answers out of Sonya. It didn't help matters that we didn't exactly have a concrete question to ask her. We mostly had a series to throw at her. Did she know about another Dragomir? Was she related to the mother? Where were the mother and child? Things also went bad when Sonya realized we needed her too much to kill her, no matter how much silver stake torture we did. We'd been at it for over an hour and were getting exhausted. At least I was. I leaned against a wall near Sonya, and though I had my stake out and ready, I was relying on the wall a bit more than I liked to admit to keep me upright. None of us had spoken in a while. Even Sonya had given up on her snarling threats. She simply waited and stayed watchful, undoubtedly planning for escape, probably figuring we'd tire before she did. That silence was scarier than all the threats in the world. I was used to Strigoi using words to intimidate me. I'd never expected the power simply being quiet and staring menacingly could have.
"What happened to your head, Rose?"
asked Dimitri, suddenly catching a glimpse of it. I'd been tuning out a little and realized he was talking to me. Huh? I brushed aside hair that had been obscuring part of my forehead. My fingers came away sticky with blood, triggering vague memories of crashing into the table. I shrugged, ignoring the dizziness I'd been feeling. I'm fine. Dimitri gave Sydney the quickest of glances.
Go lay her down and clean it up. Don't let her sleep until we can figure out if it's a concussion.
No, I can't, I argued. I can't leave you alone with her.
I'm fine, he said. Rest up so that you can help me later. You're no good to me if you're just going to fall over.
I still protested, but when Sydney gently took my arm, my stumbling gave me away. She led me to the house's one bedroom, much to my dismay. There was something creepy about knowing I was in a Strigoi's bed, even if it was covered with a blue and white floral quilt. Man, I said, lying back against the pillow once Sydney had cleaned my forehead. Despite my earlier denial, It felt great to rest. I can't get used to the weirdness of a Strigoi living in a place so... normal. How are you holding up?
Better than you guys, said Sydney.
She wrapped her arms around herself and eyed the room uncomfortably.
Being around Strigoi is starting to make you guys seem not so bad.
Well, at least some good's come out of this, I remarked. Despite her joke, I knew she had to be terrified. I started to close my eyes and was jolted awake when Sydney poked my arm.
No sleep, she chastised. Stay up and talk to me.
It's not a concussion, I muttered. But I suppose we can go over plans to get Sonia to talk.
Sydney sat at the foot of the bed and grimaced. No offense, but I don't think she's going to crack.
She will once she's gone a few days without blood.
Sydney blanched. A few days?
Well, whatever it takes to...
A spike of emotion flitted through the bond, and I froze. Sydney jumped up, her eyes darting around as though a group of Strigoi might have burst into the room.
What's wrong?
She exclaimed.
I have to go to Lyssa.
You're not supposed to sleep.
It's not sleeping, I said bluntly.
And with that, I jumped away from Sonia's bedroom and into Lyssa's perspective. She was riding in a van with five other people whom I immediately recognized as other royal nominees. It was an eight-person van and also included a guardian driver with another in the passenger seat who was looking back at Lyssa and her companions.
Each of you will be dropped off in a separate location on the outskirts of a forest and given a map and compass. The ultimate goal is for you to reach the destination on the map and wait out the daylight until we come for you.
Lyssa and the other nominees exchanged glances and then, almost as one, peered out the van's windows. It was almost noon and the sunlight was pouring down. Waiting out the daylight was not going to be pleasant but didn't sound impossible. Idly, she scratched a small bandage on her arm and quickly stopped herself. I read from her thoughts what it was. A tiny, barely noticeable dot tattooed into her skin. It was actually similar to Sydney's. Blood and earth, mixed with compulsion. Compulsion might be taboo among Maroi, but this was a special situation. The spell in the tattoo prevented the candidates from revealing the monarch tests to others not involved with the process. This was the first test.
What kind of terrain are you sending us to?
Demanded Marcus Lazar.
We're not all in the same physical shape. It's not fair when some of us have an advantage.
His eyes were on Lyssa as he spoke.
There is a lot of walking, said the guardian,
face serious.
But it's nothing that any candidate, of any age, shouldn't be able to handle. And, to be honest, part of the requirements for a king or queen is a certain amount of stamina. Age brings wisdom, but a monarch needs to be healthy, not an athlete by any means,
added the guardian quickly, seeing Marcus start to open his mouth.
But it's no good for the Maroi to have a sickly monarch elected who dies within a year. Harsh, but true. And you also need to be able to endure uncomfortable situations. If you can't handle a day in the sun, you can't handle a council meeting.
I think he intended that as a joke, but it was hard to tell since he didn't smile.
It's not a race, though. Take your time getting to the end if you need it. Marked along the map are spots where certain items are hidden. Items that'll make this more bearable, if you can decipher the clues.
Can we use our magic? Asked Ariana Zelsky.
She wasn't young either, but she looked tough and ready to accept a challenge of endurance.
Yes, you can, said the guardian solemnly.
Are we in danger out there?
Asked another candidate, Ronald O'Zara.
Aside from the sun?
That,
said the guardian mysteriously,
is something you'll need to learn for yourselves. But if at any time you want out.
He produced a bag of cell phones and distributed them. Maps and compasses followed.
Call the programmed number, and we'll come for you.
Nobody had to ask about the hidden message behind that. Calling the number would get you out of the long day of endurance. It would also mean you'd failed the test and were out of the running for the throne. Lyssa glanced at her phone, half surprised there was even a signal. They'd left court about an hour ago and were well into the countryside. A line of trees made Lyssa think they were nearing their destination. So, a test of physical endurance. It wasn't quite what she'd expected. The trials a monarch went through had long been shrouded in mystery, gaining an almost mystical reputation. This one was pretty practical, and Lyssa could understand the reasoning, even if Marcus didn't. It truly wasn't an athletic competition, and the Guardian had a point in saying that the future monarch should possess a certain level of fitness. Glancing at the back of her map, which listed the clues, Lyssa realized this would also test their reasoning skills. All very basic stuff, but essential to ruling a nation. The van dropped them off one by one at different starting points. With each departing candidate, Lyssa's anxiety grew. "There's nothing to worry about," she thought. "I've just got to sit through a sunny day." She was the next to last person dropped off, with only Ariana remaining behind. Ariana patted Lyssa's arm as the van door opened.
"Good luck, dear."
Lyssa gave her a quick smile. These tests might all be a ruse on Lyssa's part, but Ariana was the real deal. And Lyssa prayed the older woman could get through this successfully. Left alone as the van drove away, unease spread through Lyssa. The civil endurance test suddenly seemed much more daunting and difficult. She was on her own, something that didn't happen very often. I'd been there most of her life, and even when I'd left, she'd had friends around her. But now, it was just her, the map, and the cell phone. And the cell phone was her enemy. She walked to the edge of the forest and studied her map. A drawing of a large oak tree marked the beginning, with directions to go northwest. Scanning the trees, Lyssa saw three maples, a fir, and an oak. Heading toward it, she couldn't help a smile. If anyone else had botanical landmarks and didn't know their plants and trees, they could lose candidacy right there. The compass was a classic one, no digital GPS convenience here. Lyssa had never used a compass like this, and the protective part of me wished I could jump in and help. I should have known better, though. Lyssa was smart and easily figured it out. Heading northwest, she stepped into the woods. While there was no clear path, the forest's floor wasn't too covered with overgrowth or obstacles. The nice part about being in the forest was that the trees blocked out some of the sun. It still wasn't an ideal Moroi condition, but it beat being dropped in a desert. Birds sang and the scenery was lush and green. Keeping an eye out for the next landmark, Lyssa tried to relax and pretend she was simply on a pleasant hike. Yet, it was difficult to do that with so much on her mind. Abe and our other friends were now in charge of working and asking questions about the murder. All of them were asleep right now. It was the middle of the Moroi night. But Lyssa didn't know when she'd return and couldn't help resenting this test for taking up her time. No, wasting her time. She'd finally accepted the logic behind her friend's nomination, but she still didn't like it. She wanted to actively help them. Her churning thoughts almost led her right past her next landmark. A tree that had fallen ages ago. Moss covered it, and much of the wood was rotten. A star on the map marked it as a place with a clue. She flipped over the map and read. "I grow and I shrink. I run and I crawl. Follow my voice, though I have none at all. I never do leave here, but I travel around. I float through the sky and I creep through the ground. I keep my cash in a vault, although I have no wealth. Seek out my decay to safeguard your health. My mind went blank right about then, but Lissa's spun. She read it over and over again, examining the individual words and how each line played off the other. I never do leave here. That was the starting point, she decided. Something permanent. She looked around, considered the trees, then dismissed them. They could always be cut and removed. Careful not to stray too far from the fallen tree, she circled the area searching for more. Everything was theoretically transient. What stayed? Follow my voice. She came to a halt and closed her eyes, absorbing the sounds around her. Mostly birds. The occasional rustle of leaves and... She opened her eyes and walked briskly to her right. The sound she'd heard grew louder, bubbling and trickling. There, a small creek ran through the woods, hardly noticeable. Indeed, it seemed too tiny for the stream bed carved out around it.
But I bet you grow when it rains,
she murmured, uncaring that she was speaking to a stream. She looked back down at the clue, and I felt her clever mind rapidly piece it all together. The stream was permanent, but traveled. It changed size, it had a voice, it ran in deep parts, crawled when there were obstacles. And when it evaporated, it floated in the air. She frowned, still puzzling the riddle aloud.
But you don't decay.
Lissa studied the area once more, uneasily thinking decay could apply to any plant life. Her gaze moved past a large maple tree and then jerked back. At its base grew a clump of brown and white mushrooms, several wilting and turning black. She hurried over and knelt down. And that was when she saw it. A small hole dug into the earth nearby. Leaning closer, she saw a flash of color, a purple drawstring bag. Triumphantly, Lissa pulled it out and stood up. The bag was made of canvas and had long strings that would allow it to hang over her shoulder as she walked. She opened the bag and peered inside. There, tucked inside the fluffy and fuzzy lining, was the best thing of all. A bottle of water. Until now, Lissa hadn't realized how hot and dehydrated she'd grown, or how wearying the sun was. The candidates had been told to wear sturdy shoes and practical clothing, but hadn't been allowed any other supplies. Finding this bottle was priceless. Sitting on the log, she took a break, careful to conserve her water. While the map indicated a few more clues and rewards, she knew she couldn't necessarily count on any more helpful bags. So, after several minutes' rest, she put away the water and slung the little tote over her shoulder. The map directed her due west, so that was the way she went. The heat beat on her as she continued her walk, forcing her to take a few more conservative water breaks. She kept reminding herself it wasn't a race and that she should take it easy. After a few more clues, she discovered the map wasn't quite to scale, so it wasn't always obvious how long each leg of the hike was. Nonetheless, she was delighted to successfully solve each clue, though the rewards became more and more baffling. One of them was a bunch of sticks sitting on a rock, something she would have sworn was a mistake. But someone civilized had clearly tied the bundle together. She added that into her bag, along with a neatly folded green plastic tarp. By now, sweat was pouring off her, and rolling up the sleeves of her button-down cotton shirt did little to help. She took more frequent breaks. Sunburn became a serious concern. So it was a huge relief when her next clue led to a bottle of sunscreen. After a couple hours of battling the intense summer heat,
Lissa became so hot and tired that she no longer had the mental energy to be annoyed about missing out on whatever was happening at court. All that mattered was getting to the end of this test. The map showed two more clues, which she took as a promising sign. She would reach the end soon and then could simply wait for someone to get her. A flash of realization hit her. The tarp. The tarp was a sunblock, she decided. She could use it at the end. This cheered her up, as did the next prize, more water and a floppy wide-brimmed hat that helped keep the sunlight from her face. Unfortunately, after that, what appeared to be a short leg of the trip turned out to be twice as long as she expected. By the time she finally reached the next clue, she was more interested in taking a water break than digging out whatever else the guardians had left her. My heart went out to her. I wished so, so badly that I could help. That was my job, to protect her. She shouldn't be alone. Or should she? Was that also part of the test? In a world where royals were almost always surrounded by guardians, this solitude had to be a total shock. Moroi were hardy and had excellent senses, but they weren't built for extreme heat and challenging terrain. I could have probably jogged the course easily. Admittedly, I wasn't sure I would have had Lissa's deductive skills in figuring out the clues. Lissa's last reward was flint and steel. Not that she had any idea what they were. I recognized them instantly as the tools of a fire-making kit, but couldn't for the world figure out why she'd need to build a fire on a day like this. With a shrug, she added the items to her bag and kept going. And that's when things started to get cold. Really cold. She didn't entirely process it at first, mainly because the sun was still shining so brilliantly. Her brain said what she felt was impossible, but her goosebumps and chattering teeth said otherwise. She rolled her sleeves back down and quickened her pace, wishing that the sudden cold had at least come with cloud cover. Walking faster and exerting herself more helped heat her body. Until it began to rain. It started off as a mist, then changed to drizzle, and finally turned into a steady curtain of water. Her hair and clothing became soaked, making the cold temperature that much worse. Yet, the sun still shone. Its light an annoyance to her sensitive skin, but offering no warmth in compensation. Magic, she realized. This weather is magical. It was part of the test. Somehow, Moroi air and water magic users had united to defy the hot, sunny weather. That was why she had a tarp, to block the sun and the rain. She considered getting it out now and wearing it like a cloak, but quickly decided to wait until she reached the end point. She had no idea how far away that really was, though. 20 feet? 20 miles? The chill of the rain crept over her, seeping under her skin. It was miserable. The cell phone in the bag was her ticket out. It was barely late afternoon. She had a long time to wait before this test ended. All she had to do was make one call. One call, and she'd be out of this mess and back to working on what she should be at court. No. A kernel of determination flared up within her. This challenge was no longer about the Moroi throne or Tatiana's murder. It was a test she would take on for herself. She'd led a soft and sheltered life, letting others protect her. She would endure this on her own. And she would pass. This determination took her to the map's end, a clearing ringed in trees. Two of the trees were small and close enough together that Lissa thought she might be able to drape the tarp into some sort of a reasonable shelter. With cold, fumbling fingers, she managed to get it out of the bag and unfold it to its full size, which was fortunately much larger than she'd suspected. Her mood began to lift as she worked with the tarp and figured out how to create a small canopy. She crawled inside once it was complete, glad to be out of the falling rain. But that didn't change the fact that she was wet, or that the ground was also wet and muddy. The tarp also didn't protect her against the cold. She felt a flash of bitterness, recalling the guardians saying magic was allowed in this test. She hadn't thought magic would be useful at the time, but now she could certainly see the perks of being a water user to control the rain and keep it off her. Or better yet, being a fire user. She wished Christian was with her. She would have welcomed the warmth of both his magic and his embrace. For this kind of situation, spirits seriously sucked. Unless perhaps she got hypothermia and needed to try to heal herself, which never worked as well as it did on other people. No, she decided. There could be no question. Water and fire users had the advantage in this test. That's when it hit her. Fire. Lyssa straightened up from where she'd been huddled. She hadn't recognized the iron and flint for what they were, but now vague recollections of fire making were coming back to her. She'd never been taught those skills directly, but was pretty sure striking the stones together would make a spark. If she only had dry wood. Everything out there was soaked. Except for the bundle of sticks in her bag. Laughing out loud, she untied the sticks and set them in a place shielded from the rain. After arranging them in what seemed like a campfire-friendly pattern, she tried to figure out what to do with the steel and flint. In movies, she thought she'd seen people just hit them to make sparks fly. So, that's what she did. Nothing happened. She tried three more times, and her earlier excitement gave way to spirit-darkened frustration. I pulled some of that from her, needing her to stay focused. On the fourth try, a spark flew off and faded away. But it was what she needed to understand the principle. Before long, she could easily make sparks, but they did nothing when they landed on the wood. Up and down. Her mood was a roller coaster of hope and disappointment. Don't give up, I wanted to say as I drew off more negativity. Don't give up. I also wanted to give her a lesson on kindling, but that was pushing my limits. Watching her, I was beginning to realize how much I underestimated Lyssa's intelligence. I knew she was brilliant, but I always imagined her being helpless in these situations. She wasn't. She could reason things out. That tiny spark couldn't penetrate the wood of the sticks. She needed a bigger flame. She needed something the sparks could ignite. But what? Surely nothing in this waterlogged forest. Her eyes fell on the map poking out of her bag. She hesitated only a moment before ripping and shredding the paper into a pile on top of the twigs. Supposedly, she'd reached the end of the hike and didn't need the map. Supposedly. But it was too late now, and Lyssa pushed forward with her plan. First, she pulled out some of the bag's fluffy lining, adding the bits of fuzz to the paper. Then she took up the flint and steel again. A spark jumped out and immediately caught a piece of the paper. It flared orange before fading out, leaving a wisp of smoke. She tried again, leaning forward to gently blow on the paper when the spark landed. A tiny flame appeared, caught a neighboring shred, and then faded. Steeling herself up, Lyssa tried a final time. "Come on, come on," she muttered, as though she might compel a fire into existence. This time, the spark caught and held, turning into a small flame, then a larger flame that soon consumed her kindling. I prayed it would take to the wood, or else she was out of luck. Brighter and larger the flame grew, eating the last of the paper and fuzz, and then spreading along the sticks. Lyssa blew softly to keep it going, and before long the campfire was in full blaze. The fire couldn't change the piercing cold, but as far as she was concerned, she had the warmth of the entire sun in her hands. She smiled, and a sense of pride that she hadn't felt in a while spread within her. Finally able to relax, She glanced out at the rainy forest and caught the faintest flashes of color in the distance. Channeling spirit, she used her magic to intensify her ability to see auras. Sure enough, hidden far, far out among the trees, she could see two auras filled with strong, steady colors. Their owners stood still, staying quiet and covered. Lissa's smile grew. Guardians. Or maybe the air and water users controlling the weather. None of the candidates were alone out here. Ronald O'Zara had had no need to worry. But then, he wouldn't know that. Only she did. Maybe spirit wasn't so useless out here after all. The rain began to lighten, and the fire's warmth continued to soothe her. She couldn't read the time from the sky, but somehow she knew she would have no problem waiting out the day and...
Rose?
A voice summoned me out of Lissa's wilderness arrival.
Rose, wake up, or whatever.
I blinked, focusing on Sydney's face, which was a few inches from mine. What? I demanded. Why are you bothering me? She flinched and jerked away, momentarily speechless. Pulling away Lissa's darkness while joined with her hadn't affected me at the time, but now, conscious in my own body, I felt anger and irritation flood me. It's not you, it's not Sydney, I told myself. It's spirit. Calm down. I took a deep breath, refusing to let spirit master me. I was stronger than it was. I hoped. As I fought to push those feelings down, I looked around and remembered I was in Sonia Karp's bedroom. All my problems came rushing back. There was a bound Strigoi in the other room, one we were barely keeping constrained and who didn't seem like she would give us answers anytime soon. I looked back at Sydney, who still seemed afraid of me. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to snap at you. I was just startled. She hesitated a few moments and then nodded, accepting my apology. As the fear faded from her face, I could see that something else was bothering her. What's wrong? I asked. As long as we were alive and Sonia was still trapped, things couldn't be that bad, right? Sydney stepped back and crossed her arms. Victor Dashkov and his brother are here. Chapter 18. I sprang up from my bed, relieved that I didn't fall over. My head still hurt, but I no longer felt dizzy, which hopefully meant I really had evaded a concussion. Glancing at an alarm clock as I left Sonia's bedroom, I saw that I'd been in Lissa's head for a few hours. Her test had been far more extensive than I'd realized. In the living room, I found an almost comical sight. Victor and Robert stood there, in the flesh, taking in the surrounding details. Even Robert seemed to be with us mentally this time. Only whereas Victor was studying everything in his calculating way, Robert's attention was fixed on Sonia. His eyes bugged out in astonishment. Dimitri, meanwhile, hadn't altered his position near Sonia or put away the stake at her throat. It was clear from his stance and watchful gaze, however, that he regarded the brothers as a new threat and was trying, impossibly, to stay on guard against everything. He seemed relieved to see me and have some backup. Sonia had gone perfectly still within her chains, which I didn't like at all. It made me think she was planning something. Her red eyes narrowed. The whole situation was tense and dangerous, but a tiny part of me felt smug satisfaction as I studied Victor more closely. The dream meetings had been deceptive. Just as I could shift my appearance in dreams, Victor had made himself look stronger and healthier in those visits than he actually was in real life. Age, disease, and life on the run were taking their toll. Dark shadows lined his eyes, and his graying hair seemed thinner than it had a month ago. He looked haggard and tired, but I knew he was still dangerous. "So," I said, hands on hips, "you managed to find us."
"There's one lake in this town," said Victor. "One blue house.
Maybe you had trouble with those directions. But for the rest of us,
it wasn't that difficult.
Well, if you're so smart, what's your plan now?
I asked. I was trying to stall as I frantically thought about what my plan was. I'd wanted to capture Victor and Robert, but didn't know how. Since we had to split our attention between them and Sonya, Dimitri and I couldn't team up. I wished we had leftover chain. Aside from physically subduing the brothers, we would also specifically need to restrain their hands to reduce their ability to use magic.
Since you're so smart,
countered Victor,
I assumed you'd have already obtained the needed information.
I gestured towards Sonya.
She's not exactly forthcoming.
Victor's eyes fell on her.
Sonya Karp, you've changed since I last saw you.
I'm going to kill you all, Sonya snarled, and consume you one by one. Normally, I'd start with the human and work up to the Moroi, but...
She glanced at Dimitri and me, her face full of rage.
I think I'll save you two for last and drag out your suffering.
She paused and almost comically added,
You've annoyed me the most.
Do all Strigoi go through some boot camp and learn all the same threats? It's a wonder you don't cackle too. I turned back to Victor.
See? Not that easy. We've tried everything. Beaning it out, torturing it out. Sydney went through the names of all her relatives. No reaction.
Victor studied Sydney in detail for the first time.
So, your pet alchemist.
Sydney didn't move. I knew she had to be scared of facing someone who was both a vampire and a dangerous criminal. I had to give her points for meeting his stare unflinchingly.
Young, Victor mused. But of course she would be. I imagine it's the only way you could manipulate her into this little escapade.
I'm here by choice, replied Sydney. Her expression stayed calm and confident. No one manipulated me. Abe's blackmail wasn't really relevant at the moment.
Look, if you wanted to keep torturing me with your not-funny comments, you could have just kept invading my dreams, I snapped. If you don't have anything useful to offer, then get out of here and let us wait until hunger weakens Sonya.
And by get out of here, I meant, foolishly think you're going to leave so that I can knock your heads together and drag you back to the Guardians.
We can help, said Victor. He touched his brother lightly on the arm.
Robert flinched, jerking his eyes from Sonya to Victor.
Your methods were destined to fail. If you want answers, there's only one way to...
Sonya made her move. Dimitri was still right next to her, but he'd also been keeping an eye on the rest of us. And of course, I'd been completely focused on the Victor drama as well. It was probably the best opening Sonya could have hoped for. With crazy Strigoi strength, she bucked up from the chair. The chain was wrapped around her over and over, but a quick movement and strength were enough to snap the chain in two places. The rest still encircled her, but I knew perfectly well even one opening was enough for her to eventually bust out. Distracted or not, Dimitri was on her in a flash, and a second later, so was I. She was flailing in the chair, using every bit of her strength and speed to shake off the chains. If she got loose, I knew she'd put up another fierce fight. Dimitri and I met eyes briefly, and I knew we were thinking the same things. First, how were we going to re-restrain her? The chain could probably be rebound, but we'd need to unwind it and start over, which would be next to impossible. We also both knew he and I might not be able to take her down a second time, and now we had innocents around. They couldn't fight, but Sonya might be able to use them to her advantage somehow. All we could do was try to keep her down. Holding her against a flat surface like the floor would have been much easier than the unwieldy recliner. It shook as she fought against us, and we struggled to get a good position on the chair. Dimitri had his stake. I'd set mine down earlier, and he raked it against her skin, giving us some advantage in the struggle. She screamed in rage, and I clung to the hope we might tire her out. Probably not. We'd break first. My aching head was proof enough that I wasn't in peak condition. I saw a flash of movement in my periphery, sending off new alarms. Robert Giroux was heading toward us, and he had a silver stake in his hand. The sight was so bizarre and unexpected that I was slow to alert Dimitri. When my sluggish mind suddenly kicked back to life, it was too late. No! I shrieked, seeing Robert raise the stake. Don't kill her! Dimitri turned and saw Robert then, but there was nothing he could do. Dimitri and I had created the perfect opportunity. We were holding Sonya still, and with her chest vulnerable, Robert had a clean shot. Frantically, I wondered what to do. If I stopped him, I'd release Sonya. If I didn't stop him, he might kill our only chance of finding out who... Too late. The stake plunged down with a force that astonished me. Lissa had had a very difficult time staking Dimitri, and I'd assumed the same would be true for someone like Robert, who was older and seemed so fragile. But no, he still had to use two hands, but the stake went firmly into Sonya's chest, piercing her heart. Sonya let out an intense scream. A brilliant, blinding white light suddenly filled the room, just as an unseen force blasted me away. I hit a wall, my brain barely registering the pain. The small house shook, and with one hand, I tried to grab something and brace myself. I squeezed my eyes shut, but could still see starbursts. Time slowed. My heartbeat slowed. Then, it all stopped. Everything. The light, the tremors. I breathed normally. All was quiet and still, as though I'd imagined what had just happened. I blinked, trying to bring my eyes back into focus and assess the situation. I did my best to scramble clumsily to my feet and saw Dimitri was doing the same. He looked like he'd also been knocked over but had caught the wall for support, rather than smashing into it. Robert was lying flat out on the floor, and Victor rushed over to help him. Sydney just stood frozen. And Sonya? Unbelievable, I whispered. Sonya was still in the armchair, and from the way she was sitting back, it was obvious that she'd been blasted by the same force that had hit the rest of us. The chains were still around her, but she'd stopped struggling. On her lap was the silver stake Robert had held only moments ago. Sonya managed to wiggle a hand out of the chain, just enough for her fingers to brush against the stake's surface. Her eyes widened with wonder, eyes that were a rich azure blue. Robert had brought Sonya Karp back to life. She was no longer Strigoi. When Lissa had saved Dimitri, I'd felt the magic's power through the bond, giving me the full and overwhelming experience of it all. Witnessing it now, without the first-hand knowledge provided from Lissa, was still just as incredible. Victor was preoccupied with Robert, but the rest of us couldn't stop staring at Sonya in amazement. I kept looking for anything, anything that might give the slightest hint of her previous existence. There was none. Her skin bore the typical Maroi paleness, but it was still filled with the warmth of life, with the faintest tinge of color, not like the Strigoi, who were completely devoid of pigment. Her eyes were bloodshot, but that was from her rapidly forming tears. There was no red ring around her irises, and the look in those eyes, there was no cruelty or malice. They were not the eyes of someone who had just threatened to kill us all. Her eyes were all shock and fear and confusion. I couldn't tear my gaze from her. A miracle. Another miracle. Even after seeing Lissa restore Dimitri, some secret part of me had believed I would never witness anything like it again. That was how miracles worked. Once in a lifetime. There'd been a lot of talk about using spirit to save Strigoi everywhere. Talk that had faded when other drama, such as the murder of a queen, took precedence at court. The shortage of spirit users had also made the idea unpopular, and besides, everyone knew the difficulties involved with a Maroi staking a Strigoi.
If trained guardians died fighting Strigoi, how could a Moroi stake one? Well, here was the answer. A subdued Strigoi. A Moroi could manage staking one with two hands, especially with guardian backup. The possibilities made me reel. Robert's magic was strong, but he was old and frail. Yet if he had still done this, could any spirit user? He'd almost made it look easy. Could Adrian do it? Could Lyssa do it again? A miracle. Sonya Karp was a living, breathing miracle. And suddenly, she began screaming. It started off as kind of a low wail and rapidly grew in volume. The noise snapped me to attention, but I didn't exactly know how to respond. Dimitri did. His stake fell from his hand, and he rushed to Sonya's side, where he began trying to free her from the chains. She floundered at his touch, but her efforts no longer packed the supernatural strength of an undead monster seeking revenge. These were the motions of someone desperately, terribly afraid. I'd wrapped those chains pretty securely, but Dimitri had them off in seconds. Once Sonya was free, he sat in the chair and pulled her to him, letting her bury her face against his chest and sob. I swallowed. Dimitri had also wept when he had been changed back. An odd image of newborn babies flashed through my mind. Was crying the natural reaction for anyone being born? Or, in this case, reborn into the world? A sudden movement grabbed my attention. Sydney's eyes were wide and she was actually moving toward Dimitri. To stop him.
What are you doing? She cried. Don't release her!
Dimitri ignored Sydney, and I caught hold of her, pulling her back.
It's okay, it's okay, I said.
Sydney was the most stable factor in this whole operation. I couldn't have her freaking out.
She's not Strigoi. Look at her. She's Moroi.
Sydney slowly shook her head.
She can't be. I just saw her.
It's what happened to Dimitri. Exactly the same. You don't think he's a Strigoi, do you? You trust him.
I released my hold on her, and she stayed put, her face wary. Looking down at the brothers, I realized theirs might be a more serious situation than I had realized. Robert, while not a Strigoi, looked pale enough to be one. His eyes were vacant, drool escaping his partially open mouth. I reassessed my earlier observation about Robert making Strigoi restoration look easy. He'd staked her like a pro, but obviously, there were a few side effects. Victor was trying to support his brother and murmured soothing and encouraging words. And on Victor's face, well, there was a look of compassion and fear that I'd never seen before. My brain didn't entirely know how to reconcile it with my well-defined and villainous image of him. He seemed like a real person. Victor glanced up at me, his lips twisting into a bitter smile.
What? No witty quips now? You should be happy. We've given you what you wanted. You need answers from Sonya Karp?
He nodded toward her.
Go get them. They've certainly come at a high price.
No!
Exclaimed Dimitri. He still held Sonya against him, but his gentle expression turned hard at Victor's words.
Are you crazy? Didn't you see what just happened?
Victor arched an eyebrow.
Yes, I noticed.
She's in no condition to answer anything. She's in shock. Leave her alone.
Don't act like she's the one who's suffering here, snapped Victor.
Turning back to Robert, Victor helped his brother stand and go toward the couch. Robert barely managed it, his legs trembling and then giving way as he sat down. Victor put an arm around Robert.
You'll be all right. Everything's all right.
Will he be?
I asked uncertainly. Robert didn't look like he was in all that good of shape. My earlier thoughts about spirit users saving Strigoi continued growing unrealistic.
He... He did it before and recovered, right? And Lyssa's fine.
Robert was much younger, as is Vasilisa, replied Victor, patting Robert's shoulder. And this is hardly a simple spell. Doing it even once is monumental.
Weiss?
Well, you and I both know how spirit works. And this feat takes a toll on both body and mind. Robert has made a great sacrifice for you.
He had, I supposed. Thank you, Robert, I said. The words came hesitantly to my lips. Robert didn't seem to hear. Dimitri stood up, lifting Sonia easily in his arms. She was still crying, but her sobs were quieter now.
She needs to rest, he said gruffly. Believe me, you have no idea what's going on inside her right now.
Oh, I believe you, I said.
You're idiots, snapped Victor. Both of you.
It was a wonder Dimitri's glare didn't pin Victor to the floor.
No interrogation yet.
I nodded my agreement, not knowing what else to do. When Lyssa had changed Dimitri, she'd taken on a fierce, similarly protective attitude. He might not have been the one to change Sonia, but he was the only one here who had any idea what she was going through. I knew he'd had a hard adjustment and that the initial effects of the restoration had been disorienting. That wasn't even taking into account the subsequent depression. He swept past all of us, taking Sonia to her bedroom. Sydney watched them go and then glanced over to the sofa, where Victor still had his arm wrapped around his brother. The alchemist met my eyes wonderingly.
I heard, but I didn't believe.
Sometimes, I told her, I still don't. It goes against every rule of the universe. To my surprise, she touched the small gold cross around her neck.
Some rules are bigger than the universe.
Victor rose from the couch, apparently satisfied Robert was resting. I tensed up. Miracles aside, he was still a criminal, one I intended to capture. He took a step toward me, pitching his voice low.
Sorry to interrupt Metaphysics 101, but you need to listen to me, he said. Be careful, Rose. Very careful. A lot rests on you now. Don't let your pet wolf keep you from finding out what Sonia knows.
But he's right, I exclaimed. It's been 5 minutes. What she went through, what they both went through, well, it's kind of a big deal. Literally life-changing. He had to recover too and adjust to being saved. Once she does, she'll help us.
Are you sure? He asked, narrowing his eyes. Will she think she's been saved? You forget. Belikov was turned against his will.
She wasn't. What are you saying? That she's going to try to become Strigoi again? He shrugged.
I'm saying get your answer soon. And don't leave her alone.
With that, Victor turned and headed toward the kitchen. He soon returned with a glass of water. Robert drank it greedily and then fell into a heavy sleep. I sighed and leaned against a wall near Sydney, totally worn out. I still hurt from the earlier fight.
What now? Asked Sydney.
I shook my head. I don't know. We wait, I guess. Dimitri returned a little while later and spared a small glance for Robert.
She's sleeping too, he told me. The transformation. It's difficult.
I could see a haunted look in his eyes and wondered what memory was tormenting him now. The memory of being changed? The memory of being Strigoi? I don't think we should leave Sonia alone, I said. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Victor smirk. Someone should stay with her in case she wakes up. She won't know what's going on. Dimitri didn't answer for a few seconds as he scrutinized me. He knew me well enough to sense there might be something else on my mind. Fortunately, he couldn't find a fault in my logic.
You're right.
Do you mind sitting with her?
He asked Sydney. I groped for something to say. No. No, not Sydney. If Sonia did turn on us, we needed someone else on guard. Someone who could fight back. Sydney, probably guessing my problem, saved me from lying to Dimitri. Or from telling him the truth about my concerns.
She doesn't know me. It might make things worse when she wakes up. Besides...
Sydney put on that disgusted expression that alchemists excelled at.
I don't really feel that comfortable with someone who was a monster 5 minutes ago.
She's not Strigoi,
he exclaimed.
She's absolutely completely Maroi again.
Even I felt a little cowed by the harshness of his voice. But I wasn't entirely surprised at his vehement reaction. He'd had a hard time convincing others he'd changed. His face softened a little.
I know it's hard to believe, but she really has changed.
I'll stay with her then, I said.
No, no.
Dimitri shook his head.
Sydney's right about one thing. Sonia might be confused. It's better if someone's there who understands what's happened.
I started to argue that I was the only one Sonia really knew, but then decided I'd rather stay with the brothers. They seemed harmless now, but I didn't trust them. Dimitri apparently didn't either. He took a few steps forward and leaned down, speaking only an inch from my ear.
Keep an eye on them, he murmured. Robert's down right now, but might recover sooner than we think.
I know. He started to turn, then glanced back at me. His commander face had softened into something thoughtful and awestruck.
Rose?
Yeah?
That. Was that what he was like when Lisa changed me?
More or less.
I didn't realize it was...
He struggled for words. It was uncharacteristic.
The way that light filled the room. The way she'd changed. Seeing that life emerge from death. It was...
beautiful? He nodded.
Life like that. You don't... no, you can't waste it.
No. I agreed. You can't. I saw something shift in him then. It was small. Just like in the alley. But I knew then another piece of the Strigoi trauma had peeled away. He said no more, and I watched as he walked back down the hall. With nothing else to do, Sydney sat down cross-legged on the floor, holding a book in her lap. It was closed, her thoughts clearly elsewhere. Meanwhile, Victor sat back in the armchair and reclined it. He didn't look as bad as Robert, but lines of fatigue showed on both brothers. Good. The longer they were out of commission, the better. I brought in a chair from the kitchen so I could sit and survey the room. Everything was peaceful. I felt like a babysitter, which I suppose I kind of was. It had been a long day, and night soon turned the windows black. This worried me. For all I knew, Sonia had some Strigoi pals who might stop by. The fact that Donovan knew her certainly indicated she wasn't a total outcast among them. It made me extra vigilant, but at the same time, I was exhausted. The brothers were already asleep. Sydney, perhaps in an attempt to keep her human schedule, eventually found a spare blanket and pillow and curled up in a makeshift bed on the floor. And me? I was halfway between human and vampiric schedules. I had a feeling Dimitri was the same. Really, we were on a do-what's-necessary schedule, in which extensive sleep was not an option. A hum of excitement and astonishment suddenly sang through the bond. I sensed no danger or threat, but curiosity made me decide to check in with Lisa anyway. Even if I was in her mind, I knew my body would stay watchful. And I wanted to know how the rest of Lissa's test had gone. Beautifully, of course.
She rode back to court exhausted but proud of herself. She wasn't the only one. The rest of her companions all wore similar expressions. All except for Ava Drozdov. She had been the only one to break and use the cell phone to call for help. Lissa was surprised that Ava had cracked. After his earlier bitching, Marcus Lazar had seemed the most likely to bail. But no, the old man had managed it somehow, meaning he'd continue on in the Monarch trials. Ava refused to make eye contact with anyone, instead staring bleakly out the window as they traveled back to court. She would still hold a counsel spot, but her shot at being queen was gone. Lissa felt bad for her, but couldn't spare too much concern. It was the way of the trials, the way they determined the best candidates. Besides, Lissa had her own issues. Staying out in the daytime had run contrary to the normal vampiric schedule. Now she simply wanted to get back to court, find her room, and sleep for a few hours. She wanted some peace.